It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, the defense team rested its case in the trial of Jerry Burns of Manchester, a man in his 60s accused of killing a Cedar Rapids high schooler more than 40 years ago. Kate Payne, IPR's Eastern Iowa reporter, joined me a short time ago. She's been covering the trial and is out in the hallway at the Scott County Courthouse where this trial is taking place in Davenport. Hello, Kate.
Hi.
So give us an idea of what happened this week. Prosecutors wrapping up their testimony, right?
Yeah, so the prosecutorial team and the defense team both formally rested their cases this week. So now we're actually hearing rebuttal witnesses that the prosecution is calling, and then we can expect closing arguments to come pretty soon after that. A lot of this week has focused on the DNA evidence. The prosecution has made that central to this case, really trying to establish these links and demonstrate that DNA consistent with Mr. Burns' DNA was found at the crime scene.
Mm-hmm. And that one defense witness, what did he have to say? Who was this?
Yeah, so this was a man named Michael Spence, who was called from the defense, and he is a private consultant who works in forensic genetics. And basically, he came forward to raise other questions about why DNA consistent with Mr. Burns could have been found at the crime scene. So he was talking about this idea of secondary transfer of DNA. So as we're moving about in the world, we're shedding millions of skin cells, sweat, you know, maybe if you have a cut and are leaving blood behind, the idea that that DNA could maybe be deposited on a chair, somebody else sits down on the chair, picks up the DNA and takes it somewhere else. So the defense team really just trying to raise questions about what are the other, what's the other realm of possibilities, as they put it, of why DNA consistent with Mr. Burns could have happened upon Michelle Martinko's dress and maybe didn't happen while the crime was being committed. She went to a mall that night, so they're raising questions about maybe DNA was left at the mall and she picked it up on her dress.
Right. This is the stabbing death of an 18-year-old young woman, Michelle Martinko, in 1979 in December. This is the parking lot of Westdale Mall in Cedar Rapids. Was it a surprise, Kate, that the defense attorneys only brought one witness?
Well, we heard in the jury selection process the defense attorney, Leon Spies, asked prospective jurors if they would hold it against the defense team if Mr. Burns did not testify on his own behalf. So they wanted to establish from early on that jurors should not hold that against him. So we did get that sort of indication that maybe he would not take the stand. But otherwise, yeah, we've heard from many more prosecution witnesses.
Right. Okay. So, and also I understand as part of the prosecution, they played a video that showed Burns in the back of a police car following his arrest. Recount what was on that video.
Yeah, we actually saw two videos this week from the prosecution. So when officers from the Cedar Rapids Police Department went to initially interview Burns in December of 2018, there was a covert camera that caught that entire interaction. And so we saw that interaction, and then after Burns was arrested and taken into a squad car. So the jury saw the entire conversation. So the officers questioning Burns where he was that night, if there could be any other reason why his DNA profile consistent with him could be found at the crime scene. And officers testified that Mr. Burns never denied that he killed Martinko, that he never said those words.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just to recount this week, prosecutors wrapping up their testimony in midweek. Then we had the defense attorneys call one witness, this DNA expert, Dr. Michael Spence. And now today, what is happening?
So today so far, we've heard from a rebuttal witness called by the prosecution, and That's a man named Paul Bush, who works at the Iowa Department of Criminal Investigation Laboratory. He's been a supervisor there, and he specialized in DNA analysis as well as crime scene evidence. So he's collected DNA evidence from crime scenes over the years, and basically the prosecutors have called him up to try and refute what we heard from Dr. Spence yesterday. The prosecution is trying to establish, from their theory of the case, that the most scientifically reasonable explanation for why DNA consistent with Mr. Burns was found on the dress Martinko was wearing when she died is because they allege that he stabbed her to death and that he cut himself while he was stabbing her, and that his blood then ended up on her dress. Again, the defense is raising those other potentials of why DNA consistent with him could be there, but that is the prosecution's theory.
Mm-hmm. Kate Payne, you're out in the hallway outside the Scott County courthouse room where this trial is taking place. Anything to add witnessing this trial, the demeanor of the jury, other things that strike you there as important?
Well, there have been a number of people who have come to watch the proceedings over these past 2 weeks. So members of Michelle Martinko's family, people who went to high school with her, who knew her when she was younger, as well as family members of Mr. Burns as well. So there are a lot of people who have known this case over the years, Cedar Rapids residents, other Iowans, and a lot of people interested in finding out what really happened that night.
So when will this trial go to jury?
So right now we're hearing closing arguments maybe next Monday, and then the jury will get instructions from the judge, and then we'll see. They'll go into deliberations.
Okay, Kate Payne, IPR's Eastern Iowa reporter, covering a trial, the defense team resting its case in the defense of a man, Jerry Burns of Manchester, accused of killing a Cedar Rapids high schooler more than 40 years ago in December of 1979. Kate Payne, thanks for the update.
Thanks.
I spoke with Kate Payne a short time ago from the Scott County Courthouse. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This is Funnel Week at the Iowa State House. That's a hurdle that bills face at this point in the legislative session. Let's get an update on this Friday of Funnel Week at the State House from IPR State Government reporter Katarina Sestarek. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
So let's, with the week almost done, give us some highlights on what survived Funnel Week.
There was a bill dealing with work reporting requirements and increased eligibility checks for people who receive public assistance that got through the funnel deadline. A bunch of bills from the governor that would deal with professional licensing reform, workforce development, and rural Iowa initiatives like helping with rural broadband survived the funnel. One bill that would allow college athletes to earn money from endorsement deals, and then another that's aimed at addressing violent behavior in schools. Those are some that were generating a bit of buzz at the Capitol that got through the funnel deadline. Mm-hmm. There were quite a few bills related to abortion. Three that got through a House committee and so will remain eligible for debate after this deadline. There was one that would put additional licensing requirements and fees on facilities that provide abortions. Another that would require abortion providers to inform patients that it might be possible to reverse a medication abortion, even though there's really not enough reliable evidence to back that up. And then another requiring women who have a stillbirth abortion or miscarriage to choose cremation or burial for the fetal remains. One abortion-related bill that didn't survive the funnel deadline was proposed by Senator Brad Zahn. He wanted to implement a 72-hour waiting period for abortion, even though the Iowa Supreme Court already struck down that policy a couple years ago. So that didn't survive the final deadline, but Zahn said that he would probably keep trying to pass something like that later in the session.
Mm-hmm. I understand also a couple of bills having to do, in both chambers, having to do with medical cannabis survived the funnel. Tell us a little bit more about those.
Yeah, so last year the governor vetoed a bill that had to do with medical cannabis because she thought it would allow for too much THC. And so this year the Senate is proposing a bill with the same level of THC that was vetoed last year, and they're recognizing that they'll have to negotiate that down at some point. The House is proposing a much lower level that was recommended by a state advisory board on medical cannabis. And so they're kind of waiting for guidance from the governor on what she would be willing to sign into law in terms of a THC limit. And so far, she's declined to give a specific number that she would be okay with.
Interesting. What happened in terms of felon voting rights? I know that's been up for debate at the State House.
Right. So Iowa is the only state that still permanently disenfranchises all felons unless they appeal to the governor. And so this is something that the governor has made a priority, is to change that. And the Senate advanced restrictions on if her proposed constitutional amendment passes eventually. This would kick in with some restrictions on who would get their voting rights back automatically.
Mm-hmm.
So that advanced. And then the House had already passed the constitutional amendment last year, and then they kind of came in with this last-minute bill, kind of a surprise attachment to a bill, actually, at the end of this week, that would restore felon voting rights through Iowa law instead of through an amendment. It's not clear if that bill will get any traction, but it was kind of an interesting twist.
So, Katarina, on this funnel week at the Iowa State House, tell us about some that will not advance in this session.
There was a bipartisan bill that would have helped mobile home park residents protect them from dramatic rent increases. This was a response to out-of-state companies coming in, buying up Iowa mobile home parks, and then jacking up the rent without much notice. And so there was a group of Republicans and Democrats that came together to try to address those issues. And that bill had its first hearing on Monday, and it advanced with support from both parties. And then on Wednesday, a key Republican lawmaker announced that he wouldn't allow the bill to advance. They had some concerns that it would institute rent controls. But at the same time, that same day, you had people from mobile home parks around Iowa who are at the Capitol kind of begging for help from lawmakers. And the Republicans haven't ruled out doing something to help some of these people, but they did not allow that bill to advance.
Katarina, to wind up here, tell us about any highlights in items that are really not subject to this legislative funnel.
So bills dealing with taxes aren't subject to the funnel. And one of those that's major right now is the governor's proposed tax plan that she's calling the Invest in Iowa Act. She's actually holding some town halls around the state to try to get people on board with that. It would raise the sales tax to fund water quality and recreation, and also to allow for more income tax cuts. And then it would also fund mental health through state funding while reducing the property tax burden that currently goes toward mental health funding. And so this is something that's not subject to the funnel deadline. It hasn't had any hearings officially in the legislature yet. And Governor Reynolds is a Republican. The Republican leaders in the House and Senate have still said that they need to make sure that all their members understand all the parts of this massive bill before they can really get on board or advance any of these proposals from the governor. And so that'll still be an interesting discussion that is going to unfold at some point during the session.
Okay. Well, for now, thanks for the update of happenings at in the Iowa legislature this week. Katarina Sestarek, IPR's state government reporter. You can join me and Katarina, along with Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa and Stephen Gruber Miller of the Des Moines Register, on Monday on this program, when we'll be discussing Funnel Week and a lot of the items that we've discussed today in more depth. Thank you, Katarina.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, this week, the Eagle Nature Foundation released the results of its 60th annual Midwinter Bald Eagle Count. Joining us to talk about it, Terrence Ingram. He is president and executive director of the Eagle Nature Foundation. Terrence, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I'm looking at the release here. I see there's a slight decline. Give us some details.
Well, the eagles have been declining for the last almost 10 years or so. But every year we have fewer and fewer birds being seen.
Mm-hmm.
And this year we're back to only 835 birds. Last year is 875. The year before, 1156. And the year before that, 1257.
Wow. So we're just I'm trying to graph that in my head here. So from about 1200 down to 800 some this year, that's a significant decline in just a few years, isn't it?
Well, in 2013 we're at 13 we had 3900. In 14, we had 3,700, so it's down quite a ways from those highs.
Yeah, okay. So any ideas on what's causing this decline in our bald eagle population? This is in the state, right? Those numbers are for the state.
Our count covers from northern Minnesota, the St. Croix River area, all the way down to Tennessee.
Okay, back
and
to
all the way across Iowa to DeSoto Wildlife Refuge in the western part of the state.
Okay, back to the question of your ideas, your thoughts on why we're seeing this big decline.
Well, I think it's Roundup. I think Roundup is causing the decline of all the birds, and it's definitely affecting our honeybees and affecting the insects and affecting far more than a few people getting cancer.
Mm-hmm,
it's affecting our wildlife as well.
So the Roundup, the weed killer out there, and do you understand how that would affect them in terms of offspring?
It's causing defects in deer and in many other birds. Some of these birds are hatching, and they've got crossed bills and things like that when they're very young, and so they don't survive very well.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any evidence that it's Roundup? Have you talked to scientists about this?
Yeah, Judy Hoy out in Montana has some of the best evidence of Roundup. She's written several books on the defects it causes in newborn deer, the birds of prey that are out there, eagles and red-tailed hawks.
Mm-hmm. Of course, when we had the huge decline, and I understand you've been looking at these populations for decades, right, Terrence?
Well, since the early 60s. This count was started in 61. That's when I started studying the eagle. In fact, we in the 70s, we had a five-year average in the early 70s of 29%, then 30%, and then in the low 80s it was 27%, then 32%, 26%, and now we're sitting the last five-year average was 28.2%.
What do you think should be done? Has this caught the attention of lawmakers, people with the ability to do something about it?
Well, I hope so, and I hope they do it before it gets too late. I mean, we've dropped down to finding only 142 young eagles. And now young eagles, I'm talking about eagles that are 3 years of age and less, 3, 2, and 1. And we had this year we only had 142 of them sighted by our hundreds of volunteers that go out there. We do our count in a two-hour period as much as possible. So many people don't understand the eagle. They don't understand that it flies at 60 to 80 miles an hour and can be seen at two or three different locations on the same day. But we've got hawkmasters on the Mississippi that for years now have sent me hourly counts of their eagles at their locks. And that's just tremendous information because it shows that they might have a few number of eagles in the morning. In the afternoon, they have a great number, and the following morning, they don't have many. But the next dam above them will have a number of eagles just the next day.
Hmm.
You know, so it's, the birds are moving, and they're very mobile. In the summertime, people don't see eagles very much because the eagles, when they're nesting, they've got about a 1 mile distance away from the nest that they have a feeding territory. But in the wintertime, a community of bald eagles will have a feeding territory of 250 square miles. So one or two eagles be flying around in that 250 square miles, and everybody's seeing eagles. And there's lots of eagles, everybody's seeing them.
Right.
And there's only a few eagles out there that are flying around trying to find something to eat.
Well, it's interesting because, Terrence, when I bike to work, also during the winter, I cross the Iowa River, and the bridge I cross on the far bank, I can see a couple of large trees. And it's not unusual for me to see maybe a dozen bald eagles in those trees. But you're saying this is deceiving in terms of the overall population.
Right, because they move in communities. And the communities used to be 60, 80, 120, 150 birds in the community. Now, if we have a community of 20 birds, that's a big community. They just aren't out there to be moving like they used to.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 65, I remember sitting on the bluff at Cassville and counting over 450 eagles flying by in a single day.
Really?
North. That's right.
Bald eagles?
Yep. That was in 1965.
Wow.
And you can't find, we don't have that many birds south of us that people can see. And we used to see communities, I remember one time at Dubuque, Iowa, Francis Lake, just south of Dubuque. My wife and I counted 380 birds at Francis Lake in one day. I had a bus tour that I was giving 2 days later on Saturday, and I was so excited because I was going to be able to show people eagles. And when we got there Saturday, there were 20 birds.
Mm. Terrence Ingram, before we say goodbye, tell us briefly, what do you think needs to be done to reverse this trend?
We have to ban Roundup. That is the first step for the eagles, for the birds, for the honeybees, for the insects. We've got to ban Roundup. We've got to quit spraying our fields with so much poison. It's washing into our streams and getting into our whole environment.
Okay. Terrence Ingram, President and Executive Director of the Eagle Nature Foundation, talking about the results released this week of the 60th annual Midwinter Bald Eagle Count, a count that is conducted by hundreds of volunteers from Minnesota to Tennessee to west to Nebraska. And Terrence has been involved in counting bald eagles, as he said, since the 1960s. Terrence, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with more of our News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's say you have a serious medical emergency in your family, at your home later today. What do you do? Well, you call an ambulance, right? Well, did you know there's no guarantee an ambulance will be available? It's true, and it's especially a problem in rural parts of our state. IPR's health reporter Natalie Krebs has been looking into the problem. She joins me now to talk about it. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, Ben.
So you are working on a feature on this. We'll be able to hear that on Monday morning edition. But give us some of the basics. Why is it that if I need an ambulance, there's no guarantee one will come, especially outside of Iowa cities?
So basically, you know, EMS isn't an essential service under Iowa law, and that means that there's no dedicated, you know, state and local taxes that go to fund it. And so basically means a lot of departments, some rural departments, are basically relying on the community to support them. And that could mean, you know, some do get general revenue, local tax funds to support them. But others are kind of just relying on bake sales. They're relying on billing patients from, you know, private health insurance plans, Medicaid plans, Medicare plans, to keep operating, and a lot of them are struggling to get by on that. They're not getting the funds they need, and a lot of them just have issues getting volunteers. It's a big commitment to become an EMT, and they don't have the money to, like, pay people to be EMTs. And so it's a lot of these departments are kind of struggling. And so it's not essential. It means that, you know, these local areas don't have to guarantee ambulance service. Mm-hmm. So when you call 911 in a rural area, it could be that if your local department doesn't have someone available, an EMT on staff, most of the time it just means you need to page the next closest service. And that could be, you know, 20 miles, 30 miles away. And that is just, you know, so much longer to get to the hospital.
Yeah, right. Natalie, well, that may be a surprise to many of our listeners, certainly to me, that in Iowa, what you said, emergency medical services are not considered essential. Certainly essential when you are the one suffering the emergency. But you spoke with a woman, and we'll hear her voice on Monday when this piece airs. You spoke with a woman whose husband died in 2016, perhaps because there was a delay in receiving emergency medical attention. Tell us her story.
Yeah, Donna Hansen lives in Hudson, Iowa, and she's just about 20 miles outside Waterloo, about 20 miles away from the nearest hospital. Hudson's a small town. I think it has about, you know, less than 2,000 people. And, you know, she was out one day about 4 years ago. Her daughter, her adult daughter, was home with her husband. Her husband started having a heart attack. Her daughter called 911, went down 2 miles to the Hudson Fire EMS station, and they had a driver available. They didn't have an EMT available. And it just meant they had to page an ambulance from Waterloo. And meanwhile, her husband's condition was deteriorating. Her daughter ended up having to, you know, drive 7 miles up towards the hospital sort of frantically to meet this ambulance coming from this hospital 20 miles away. They pulled over at this intersection, were able to load him in finally, got him to the hospital. But unfortunately, he passed away. And, you know, 4 years later, Donna told me, you know, she just wonders, he wasn't able to just get to the hospital right away. If things would have been different, maybe if that ambulance had been ready at their local station to just transport him right away down the road, if there hadn't been a delay mm-hmm. in getting him there.
What a distressing story. To look for a sort of an explanation, the bigger picture of this, you spoke with the president of the Iowa Emergency Medical Services Association. What did you find out when you spoke with him?
Yeah, Mark Sacken is the president of the Iowa Emergency Medical Services Association. And he just basically said that, you know, these rural departments, they need help. A big issue is getting EMTs to be able ready to be able to be in these departments. And, you know, there's sort of this hodgepodge service across the state where it's sort of neighboring services helping neighboring services, you know, trying to get people through training, trying to get all the supplies they need. And he is just saying they need to, you know, it's probably the state needs to act to make it an essential service, to set up a better network, to have money available for training, to be able to find a better way to get, you know, more EMTs in rural areas.
Mm-hmm. And you outline, you found out, one North Central Iowa County, Wright County, took some action a couple of years ago. What did they do?
Yeah, so Wright County, 2 years ago in 2018, they put a property tax levy before voters to make it an essential service. And what happened was they lost one of their ambulance services a couple years ago in Dowse, Iowa. They were unable to stay open. They didn't have enough volunteers. And it was sort of, the county supervisors there said it was this wake-up call. So they went ahead, they made an advisory council. They looked at Iowa code, and they realized that they could put this property tax levy before voters to make it an essential service, and they did. Voters passed it. They raised, you know, $500,000 a year, and they're putting it towards, you know, funding training, supplies. And then they also have this countywide EMS coordinator, and he's the one that sort of coordinates services, making sure that everyone has someone available when they need it. And also, you know, look, he's tracking response times to, you know, see what's happening across Wright County. And the one thing they're saying is, unfortunately, it sunsets in 5 years under Iowa law. And so they're saying in 5 years, they're going to have to put this before voters again, actually, mm-hmm. to see if it continues.
So did you find out if there's any signs that the Iowa legislature will act on this?
There's a couple things going through the legislature now. Mainly one bill sponsored by Republican Representative Bobby Kaufman would sort of make it easier for counties to do what Wright County did and remove that five-year sunset. So it would basically mean that counties could declare a service as essential, and then they could use existing tax revenue to put towards ambulance services, to EMT services. And then, of course, if they were going to do what Wright County did to raise taxes, they'd have to put that before voters. And then, you know, Representative Kaufman has also said he's asking the state for $5 million in funding to help rural EMS departments.
Interesting. Natalie Krebs, we'll look forward to your piece on Monday. But this sounds, I mean, you've really dug into this and probably revealed some of the history of how we got to this point.
Yeah, it has kind of an interesting history. EMS services started about, you know, in the mid-20th century, and a lot of places it started out, the funeral home really helped out, and they would kind of lend their hearse to help people be transferred to the hospital, just because that was obviously the best vehicle to be able to lay someone down to transport them to the hospital. And so it's sort of just, it's kind of, we've stuck with that model since then. It's just sort of neighbors helping neighbors, you know, people volunteering to help get to the hospital.
Okay, IPR's health reporter Natalie Krebs. We'll look forward to hearing your piece on Morning Edition this coming Monday. Thank you so much, Natalie.
Thanks, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, Tony Daner of Iowa Public Radio Studio One Tracks will be with us to groove us into the weekend. We love to do that on Fridays. But first of all, how do you determine the age of a fingerprint? Well, that's a forensic science puzzle that chemists at Iowa State University have solved. We'll talk about it right now with Young-Jin Lee. He's a professor of chemistry at Iowa State University. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
Now, this is a new academic paper authored by you, a chemist, but also Paige Hinners and Madison Thomas. Let's start off here by just establishing that this is something separate than what we typically think of in fingerprint analysis, where we look at the various designs, the arches, the loops, with which we can identify a person through his or her fingerprints, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So fingerprints are mostly used for the pattern matching, so that find the suspect. But what we looked at for the last several years is whether we can use chemical information of the fingerprint to get some additional information about the suspect. But then all of a sudden, Paige made this discovery that we can actually determine the age of a fingerprint from the degradation pattern of some body oil compound.
Okay, so we are, when I'm, let's say I'm touching, we all touch our cell phones, right? So I touch mm-hmm. my cell phone, and what comes off there? This is oil, and it's got a lot of different substances in that oil?
Right, so there are many different compounds from your body, secreted through your finger pores. So especially fat, what we call triacylglycerol, are one of the major components, but also there are amino acids, fatty acids, cholesterol, and there are many endogenous compounds, natural body compounds are coming out at the fingerprint.
Mm-hmm. And we know, or Paige made this discovery, that some of those things, they degrade. I'll touch my cell phone today, and then if we look at that same fingerprint in a week, it will have changed?
That's right. So especially unsaturated triacylglycerol react with ambient ozone, and they degrade, and we can see those patterns using our instrumentation.
Mm-hmm. And what are the tools that you use here?
So the tool we use is called mass spectrometry. It's an instrument that can measure the mass of a very complex mixture at the same time, very accurately. And with that, we can tell tangible different very terasoglycerol compound, and we can see the pattern. And we she realized that the unsaturated triacylglycerol are degrading, and at the same time there are some other low mass region. We can see degradation products are increasing. That's how we made this discovery.
Oh, I see. The oils, they change in their composition over time. They degrade into other things.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying, Professor, that up to this point, in terms of forensic fingerprint evidence, there's been no headway in telling us about the age of the print? This is the first time that the age of the print has been sort of possibly nailed down?
I think so. So there has been several efforts previously, but they are all unreliable. They are based on some physical pattern degradations, or there are some GCMS data, but that was also not reliable. I think this data is most reliable and robust. We still have a long way to go. We need to study some what are the effects of other environment, like temperature, humidity, or even ambient ozone concentration. There are still several years we need to study more details, but we can see the pattern very reliably. So it's probably the best way to go.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like what you're saying, just like, let's say, things we don't like to have degrade, like the food in our refrigerator, mm-hmm. That we keep it in the refrigerator because it's cold and it degrades slower when it's in a lower temperature. So fingerprint oils, it sounds like you're saying, are the same way, depending on the environment that they're in, cold, warm, humid or not, their degradation will change.
That is possible. So that's what we need to study further.
Okay, so let's have you sort of imagine, help us imagine how this might be used in the future.
So so hopefully in next several years, we'll find that this technology is very reliable. Then it can be applicable to the case where the suspect is found, but he may say that I have been there a week ago. Then, and then for some real possible scenarios, then we can tell whether he's really at the crime time or not. But with our technology, we can tell this fingerprint has been 1 day old, or 2 day old, or 3 day old. And then we can tell that whether he's making a lie or it's real.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you can imagine we could be as precise as the number of days, like this fingerprint is exactly, or is it 10 to 15 days old or something like that? You could give a range of days that it's in.
So our technique would be most useful for the first few days. So we can, after 7 days, they are mostly degraded and we may not tell exactly.
Mm.
But the first few days are usually most important. Hopefully we can give some answers.
Oh, okay. So there would be a point at which the fingerprint oil, the compounds would stop degrading. Say, let's just say after 30 days, that fingerprint oil will stay pretty much the same way for the next few months.
Right. If they're all degraded, then there's nothing much we can measure.
Mm-hmm. And finally, but before we get to the point where this would be used in forensic evidence as practiced by law enforcement, what needs to happen?
First of all, we don't want this. We want to make sure this technology is reliable. And so one of the studies that we are going to do is we're going to get volunteers from 100 or 200 people to make sure it can be applicable in many different cases. And we're going to study the kinetics so that it can be applicable to many different scenarios. So because we don't want to send wrong person into the prison.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Okay. Well, thank you very much for this very interesting conversation. An academic paper written by Young Jin Lee, professor of chemistry at Iowa State University, as well as Paige Hinners and Madison Thomas, chemists, looking at whether we can determine the age of fingerprints in the future. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you.
Well, finishing up our program today, a look to Monday's program, bills on medical cannabis, abortion, and felon voting rights among the pieces of legislation that survived funnel week at the State House this week. It's the first funnel week coming to an end. I'll talk about the bills, the legislation that survived the first funnel on Monday with State House reporters Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa, Stephen Gruber-Miller of the Des Moines Register, also IPR's own Katarina Sestarek. That's Monday on this program. Well, let's get to grooving into the weekend. We love to do it at the end of the day, at the end of our News Buzz edition. Tony Daner is with us of IPR Studio One Tracks. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Ben.
It's been a tough week. What do you got for us?
Okay.
I want to relax. I want to listen to Studio One into the weekend.
All right. Well, 7 nights a week, you can hear your daily soundtrack on Studio One Tracks. But as long as we're here right now, let's hear from Puss in Boots first. This is a super group of sorts. The great Nora Jones is a member of this band, along with Sasha Dobson and Catherine Popper, two other great musicians. They've got this new full-length record, and you can really hear all three of them on this song. It's You and Me from Puss in Boots.
Fire inside, cinders of pride, the taste of love. Dance to the beat, tempo you'll keep. A broken heart, the current is strong, drifting along. It's a dream. I'll walk the ways right from the start for you. A triple haze, you left your mark on me. These summer days we'll see.
The voices of Nora Jones, Sasha Dobson, and Catherine Popper, otherwise known as Puss in Boots. Very nice.
Yeah, that's a Sasha Dobson song, but all three of their voices really come through.
They really do meld together well. Tony, we have time for one more to take us out.
Yeah, one of the most anticipated releases of the year at Studio One, and it's here already, Tame Impala with a new record. Kevin Parker is the mastermind behind Tame Impala. He writes all the songs and plays all of the instruments in the studio. He's also a big tinkerer. This song, Borderline, from Tame Impala.
Tame Impala, the name of that band, Borderline, the tune. Tony Daner introducing us to it. Tune in to your daily soundtrack, IPR Studio One. As Tony said, 7 nights a week at 7 o'clock, the best in new music and old favorites. Thanks for grooving us into the weekend today, Tony.
Always ready to groove, Ben. Thank you.
All right, and we'll go out with Tame Impala here. River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Do tune in on Monday once again. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.